So on the one hand, we supposedly fought a war to stop the threat of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, while at the very same time, our government is pushing forward to develop new types of nuclear weapons.
Over 3,000 Palestinians have been killed since September 2000. Over 800 Israelis have been killed since September 2000. The vast majority on both sides are innocent, unarmed civilians. The blood is on the hands of the people in Washington.
I've been a pilot and I've done the mathematics, and if those jets had accelerated to their full speed of 2,000 miles per hour, they would have intercepted the second airliner before it hit the South Tower.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, September 8th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. An alleged spokesman for the Al-Qaeda network is warning of more anti-American attacks, according to the BBC, but is denying any role in the recent bombing in the Iraqi holy city of Najaf, which killed the top Shia Muslim cleric Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim and 80 others. According to the BBC report, the speaker, identified as Abd al-Rahman al-Naji, warned there will be new operations inside and outside Afghanistan that will make the United States forget the September 11, 2001 events. He said Osama bin Laden is among those leading and directing the battles from inside Afghanistan. The audio tape message was broadcast on the Al Arabiya satellite television station, denounced last month by the State Department as irresponsible for showing masked men threatening to kill members of the U.S.-appointed Iraq Governing Council. The report, coming just days before the second anniversary of the September 11th attacks, are a sore reminder that the U.S. has failed to capture Osama bin Laden or to neutralize the threat from Al-Qaeda. Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld visited Afghanistan over the weekend, just as the government reports it foiled a Taliban attack near the Pakistani border just hours before Rumsfeld arrived. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan following the September 11th attack, seeking to capture Osama bin Laden and remove the Taliban from power in its war on terrorism. The U.S.-installed government in Afghanistan is weak, warlordism is rife, and the Taliban and its allies are resurgent. Reuters News reports that scores of residents demonstrated yesterday in Kabul, Afghanistan, against the U.S.-led forces and called for the return of the Taliban. The U.S. is providing $900 million a month for American military operations in Afghanistan. An administration official who asked to remain anonymous says President Bush will announce a large increase in financial aid to that country in the next few weeks. War Secretary Rumsfeld said today opposition to the U.S. president was encouraging Washington's enemies and hindering his war against terrorism. Rumsfeld was speaking after his trip to Afghanistan and Iraq, where he sought to highlight progress on reconstruction efforts and dampen criticism of the U.S. presence there and almost daily casualties in a guerrilla campaign against occupation. Addressing the nation last night, President Bush gave a status report on the U.S.'s war on terrorism, and he listed a series of objectives for the American presence in post-war Iraq. The U.S. will continue to take direct action against the Iraqi terrorists and those who attack U.S. troops, Bush said. It will seek international cooperation in the reconstruction and security of the country, and it will push for the transfer of political sovereignty and authority for the Iraqi people. Bush also acknowledged the rising number of attacks against U.S. troops by so-called enemies of freedom who, quote, want to shake the will of the civilized world. While stating that further hardships are on the horizon, Bush said there remains no option.
2 years ago, I told the Congress and the country that the war on terror would be a lengthy war, a different kind of war, fought on many fronts in many places. Iraq is now the central front. Enemies of freedom are making a desperate stand there. And there, they must be defeated. This will take time and require sacrifice. Yet we will do what is necessary. We will spend what is necessary to achieve this essential victory in the war on terror, to promote freedom, and to make our own nation more secure.
Bush also asked Congress for an emergency increase in funding to cover the continuing cost of the occupation and reconstruction.
Our strategy in Iraq will require new resources. We have conducted a thorough assessment of our military and reconstruction needs in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. I will soon submit to Congress a request for $87 billion. The request will cover ongoing military and intelligence operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, which we expect will cost $66 billion over the next year. This budget request will also support our commitment to helping the Iraqi and Afghan people rebuild their own nations after decades of oppression and mismanagement. We will provide funds to help them improve security, and we will help them to restore basic services such as electricity and water, and to build new schools, roads, and medical clinics. This effort is essential to the stability of those nations and therefore to our own security. Now and in the future, we will support our troops and we will keep our word to the more than 50 million people of Afghanistan and Iraq.
President Bush addressing the nation last night, congressional Democrats were quick to criticize the request for additional funds, saying Bush's remarks were vague and lacked a clear exit strategy for U.S. forces. He retreated to the same rhetoric about progress and peace that do not match the reality occurring every day in Iraq, said Democratic Senator John Edwards of North Carolina. It's a country consumed with chaos, not a shining example of progress in the war against terrorism. Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas resigned over the weekend. In tendering his resignation, he said Israel had not carried out its obligations under the roadmap for peace. The United States had not enforced Israeli compliance, and his detractors at home had constantly undermined him. After Abbas's resignation, Israel dropped a 550-pound bomb on an apartment complex in Gaza City in an apparent attempt to kill Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, the founder and spiritual leader of the Islamic Resistance Movement and other members of the organization, according to the Christian Science Monitor. Peace Watch spoke with Michael Lerner of Tikkun and Rashid Khalidi, director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. Rabbi Lerner, we asked them what Abbas's resignation meant to the peace process in the region.
Well, I think the only surprising thing was that it took so long for this experiment to fail. What was expected of Mahmoud Abbas was beyond anyone's power to do. To expect a Palestinian leader to launch a Palestinian civil war in the absence of significant major change on the other side, showing that there was going to be a clear, visible, tangible reward, like an end to the siege on Palestinian homes and towns and villages, like the release of thousands of prisoners, like removal of settlements, like guarantees of Palestinian statehood and sovereignty, and so on and so forth. To expect any Palestinian leader to start a Palestinian civil war, which is what is being asked for. When they say terrorist infrastructure, they're talking about a party that has the support of approximately a fifth of the Palestinian people. It was always unrealistic, and the only question was how long it would take for this experiment to fail, and it took a little under 3 months.
And Rabbi Lerner, your reaction to Mahmoud Abbas's resignation?
Well, I'm very saddened by his resignation because I think that he is a voice of sanity and of moderation in the Palestinian world and a symbol of for many of the new kinds of voices that need to emerge in Palestine that recognize that the only way towards peace is a way that is a path of nonviolence and a path that reassures the Israeli people that they're not going to be destroyed by a militant and angry Palestinian people. So I'm very saddened that he has left, and I agree with Rashid very much that the circumstances under which he was being asked to operate were impossible, and that the only way he could have possibly operated would have been had Israel shown good faith and actual generosity of spirit in trying to turn this hudna, the ceasefire, into a new moment in Israeli-Palestinian relations in which, with a spirit of generosity, it took more than what was required rather than what actually it was doing, which was undermining at every stage the spirit and, in some cases, the letter of the agreement.
with the absence of Mahmoud Abbas, does this actually hinder the peace process, or is this, in your opinion, an opportunity to advance it, Rabbi Lerner and then Rashid?
Well, I think that Abbas also was taking a step to try to push things forward by saying, look, it can't go on the way it is, so if you want to change anything, I'll get out of the way, and you won't be able to use me as the fig leaf for what's actually going on, because what's actually been going on is the construction of a wall that was expropriating de facto land from the Palestinians, or at least it was intending to do that, to expropriate land in the West Bank at the very moment when supposedly we were in the middle of a process to negotiate the outcome of what would happen to the West Bank. And similarly, the house demolitions and destruction of property and other actions that Israel was taking, and then finally the targeted assassinations. These are activities which he was being asked to provide a fig leaf for, and he was not willing to do that. So I think that could be a good moment. On the other hand, insofar as there's now no voice that has a credible stand inside the United States representing Palestine, it's going to be easier for Ariel Sharon to simply focus on the provocative and immoral actions of Hamas and to respond to them with more and more violence. And of course, I think that is his strategy. He has taken actions to kill Hamas leaders, let's say, with full knowledge of the likelihood that killing Hamas leaders would lead to acts of terror against the Israeli population. The acts of terror would then legitimate further acts of assassination, but also further acts of undermining the freedom of the Palestinian people. And that cycle, I think, is something that Sharon has encouraged, I won't say with intention, but certainly his actions are ones that have produced a downward spiral, and I think he wants that downward spiral because I think he wants to have no credible Palestinian voice for nonviolence and peace so that he can justify holding on to larger and larger sections of the West Bank.
And so, Rashid Khalidi, do you believe that the absence now of Abbas is going to hinder or advance the peace process?
Well, I think that the Palestinians have a very serious problem, which is that, once again, it looks like they don't have a clear voice arguing for the kind of compromise solution with Israel that the majority of Palestinians, year in, year out, consistently, for well over a decade, have shown that they want. This fact is brilliantly obscured both by Hamas's actions and by Israeli propaganda, which tries to make it look as if the Palestinians, en masse, in their majority, want nothing but to destroy Israel, one of the greater falsehoods of the latter half of the 20th century. Blame can be laid on Sharon, and I would agree with Rabbi Lerner that a great deal of blame should be placed on the Israeli military and the Israeli government. And whatever blame we can place on the Palestinian leadership for their feckless performance, I think we're missing out on the primary, or one of the primary parties, which is the United States. I think that the failure of the United States to talk about the kinds of things that Israel will have to do immediately, and without which there can be no talk of a peace process, like stopping eating up the pie that the two sides are supposed to negotiate sharing by land expropriation, like releasing the imprisoned Palestinian population who've been locked up in their cities and towns and villages for month after month after month, year after, literally more than a year or two now, talking about anything but these things as prerequisites for a peace process on the part of the administration. It's just terribly irresponsible. Mm. And one hears occasionally a peep or a squeak or a yelp from this or that administration official about maybe prisoners should be released, perhaps Israel shouldn't be assassinating people when there's a ceasefire. Conceivably, it might be a good idea for the most egregious of the settlement expansions to be curtailed. But to talk in the kind of blunt terms that they have to talk about a complete change in Israel's behavior at the same time as they talk bluntly about how there has to be an end to attacks on Israeli civilians, to my way of thinking, means that Washington is not entirely serious Or they're more serious about domestic considerations here than they are actually serious about achieving peace in the Middle East, and that once again we go back to default mode, which is as long as it doesn't affect the domestic situation, we really don't care what they do about it, and we can pretend that there's a peace process, which is what has been the case in Washington for most of the past several decades. And I think that that is worse than irresponsibility. I think that's malign neglect by the United States of a situation where it is a major actor, where it is contributing billions of dollars on several sides, not just to Israel, to Egypt, to Jordan, to the Palestinian Authority. It is the big gorilla in the Middle East. And for the United States to be involved in that kind of malign neglect means that it is guilty. That when Israeli civilians die, when Palestinian civilians die, over 3,000 Palestinians have been killed since September 2000. Over 800 Israelis have been killed since September 2000. The vast majority on both sides are innocent, unarmed civilians. The blood is on the hands of the people in Washington who, by their malign neglect, have failed to address the root causes of this problem.
It sounds like, Rashid, you're saying that the U.S. is basically more interested in subsidizing the violence as opposed to really supporting any sort of roadmap to real peace.
It's managing the situation, and it is in effect subsidizing, at least on one side, the violence. That's true. I mean, these are not just American dollars that are propping up the Israeli economy to the tune of at least $3 billion. But it's also American weapons. These are American Apache helicopters, American Hellfire missiles, American sometimes guidance systems used by the main battle tanks that are firing 120-millimeter shells in refugee camps where they can go through 12 or 14 cinder blocks walls before they finally kill somebody. I mean, the United States is subsidizing and arming and propping up a situation in which not just Israelis are being killed, but about three times as many Palestinians are being killed. And it bears repeating again and again, the overwhelming majority on both sides of these 4,000 people are innocent civilians.
And Rabbi Lerner, do you agree that the U.S.'s role throughout this peace process has been lacking? And does it matter then, and I pose this to both of you, who the next person would be to step into that space that Mahmoud Abbas has left vacant?
Well, I do believe that the United States has a tremendous responsibility in this situation, and I believe that it has given perfunctory statements to Israel to change its policies, but it has not really given any serious effort to use the power that it has. I mean, if you'll recall, before the war in Iraq, one of the arguments that was made by supporters of the war was that it would lead to a situation in which the United States would then, through having the credibility of destroying Israel's primary military antagonist in the area, would make it possible for the United States to then exercise tremendous influence in the Middle East and end this Palestinian-Israeli struggle. Well, that certainly has not happened. The United States has not used its influence, has not used its power, and it ought to. And in fact, what we're saying at Tikkun and the Tikkun community, this national organization that we've created of Jews and Christians and Muslims who are working together to try to change American policy, what we're saying is that what we need, number one, from the United States right now is for the United States to reverse the order of the roadmap and to have final negotiations on what the outcome of a roadmap would be happen immediately. So that instead of telling people, hey, there's a several-year process, and at the end of which, then we'll have negotiations about what the outcome will be, to define right now what that outcome will be and make it clear to both sides that this is what the outcome is. And in our resolution to Middle East peace, which we have on our website at www.tikkun.org, and in our work in Congress right now, we are putting forward this view of a particular settlement. And we think that the settlement proposal needs to be put forward, and it needs to be put forward vigorously by the United States. The United States has to stop saying it's an honest broker and instead put forward and push Israel and push the Palestinians to an agreement that involves return of Israel to the pre-67 borders and reparations for the Palestinian people and many details of a real settlement. And the United States needs to do that. and use its power to do that immediately. So I would not so much focus on this specific or that specific, but rather on a full, complete, comprehensive settlement, and to push that onto the agenda immediately and before the United States gets lost in the 2004 election.
Well, Palestinian President Yasser Arafat has already nominated a new prime minister, Ahmed Karay. And can you tell us about his background and whether or not he is a person that you suspect would be able to help further this process or not?
Ahmed Karay, known as Abu al-Ala, was in charge of the PLO's economic interests. An organization called Summit. He was one of the primary architects of the Oslo Accords. He is someone who believes in, and to some extent I think understands how to deal with Israel. He has all the faults of the PLO leadership, however, being a charter member of that group. And he is also a crony of Arafat's, which means he might be in a somewhat stronger position vis-a-vis Arafat. He won't be seen as much of a rival to Arafat as Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, was. On the other hand, he is going to have to do the impossible, square the circle of Israel's policy, which I think, as Rabbi Lerner correctly said, is designed to destroy any kind of moderate alternative so that the Israeli army can continue its heartfelt desire to destroy the Palestinians militarily. That's really what they want to do. If the press would do its job and report what the Israeli Minister of Defense and Chief of Staff say regularly, systematically, almost every week, about a military victory being the only thing that they are interested in, then it would be clearer that this is what the Sharon government is trying to do. It wants to get into a fight with Hamas. It wants to push Palestinians towards the extreme. And Korea will have the same problem that poor Mahmoud Abbas had of trying to convince Washington of this and trying to interpose Washington between this Israeli imperative, and between Hamas, which also wants a military solution, which also believes that conflict is good for it because it sees the destruction of the Palestinian Authority as strengthening its chance to become the dominant force in Palestinian politics. So he's caught. He will be caught if he ever takes the job, as was his predecessor, between the devil and the deep blue sea, between this powerful Israeli military drive to destroy the Palestinians as a viable political force, and between the complete indifference of Washington to what really happens, in my view, and between his domestic political rivals, or the domestic political rivals of Fatah and the PLO and the PA, which is to say Hamas and the other militant groups.
And so, finally, Rashid, if you could just speak on we heard from Rabbi Lerner in a bit of detail what his organization would like to see happen in terms of helping to construct some sort of real peace in the Middle East. Do you have some suggestions on where the parties involved might go from here towards that end?
You know, I think everybody has to do their own thing to some extent. I think that for the Palestinians to wait for the United States to do the right thing or the Israelis to do the right thing is a bit naive. The Palestinians have to get their house in order. It's a mess. They have to define clearly what they want, make it clear to the rest of the world, and impose domestically on their own body politic some kind of discipline about how they're going to achieve national liberation. Majority of Palestinians don't actually believe that Israel can be destroyed or that that's a viable objective, and yet a minority is forcing its views on the majority. If the majority cannot impose on Hamas and the other armed militant groups the will of the majority, then the Palestinians are going to continue to go down the abyss. As far as Israel is concerned, the majority of Israelis cannot see where this leadership is taking them, then they will pay the price in the end. They cannot rule over another people by force.
And
ultimately,
so
they're going to end up having to live with the Palestinians, and it's up to the Israeli people, most of whom, by every poll I've read, are pretty sensible as far as issues like settlements and a Palestinian state are concerned, to come up with a political leadership that will stand up to the Sharon government. Finally, it's about time for the American people to stand up and tell the American government they really want us to do everything that should be done, want that government to do everything that should be done to bring about peace in the Middle East, and not allow gestures and empty, meaningful phrases to substitute for real action by a superpower, for God's sakes, a multi-billion dollar contributor to several governments there, which acts as if it's a spectator that can't really affect things. That's just not good enough.
Rabbi Lerner, any final thoughts on your part?
Yes, I think it's one of the tragedies in trying to build the movement for peace in the Middle East is that we find many Americans saying, well, I'm not Jewish or I'm not Muslim, so this isn't really my issue. And many Christians saying, and I don't want to be called anti-Semitic if I get into criticizing Israel, but I represent a significant section of American Jews and Jews worldwide who recognize that Israeli policy is destructive to the best interests of the Jewish people, destructive to the best interests of Israeli security, destructive to the Palestinian people, and destructive to the interests of world peace. So this is a moment when we really need the people of the United States to stand up and say, yes, we want to get involved with you. We want to get involved in building a peace process there. We want to insist that every presidential candidate have a detailed and clear perspective on exactly how they will use American power to end this struggle in the Middle East.
Rabbi Michael Lerner of Tikkun Magazine and Rashid Khalidi, director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. With Bush's speech last night full of phrases like enemies of freedom and terrorists from the, quote, uncivilized world, we turn now to the radio satire and collage collective, the Department of Corrections, who managed to take excerpts of Bush's words from another recent speech he gave and use them against him.
All of you, all in this generation of our military, the shock troops of a hateful ideology.
Good old-fashioned brutality.
The shock troops of a hateful ideology.
Everything in its place.
The shock troops of a hateful ideology have taken up the highest calling of history. The use of force has been and remains the greatest strength of our country. As I speak, a special operations task force led by the 82nd Airborne. We are hunting down 150 babies and those who seek to undermine the beginning of the end of America. We continue to help many terrorists, the Taliban, and the camps where they trained.
Good old-fashioned brutality. Everything in its place.
And we will stand with the new leaders of Iraq as they establish a government of
corporate America,
by
corporate America,
and for
corporate America.
Leave the room in disgrace.
The shock troops.
The shock troops.
The shock troops
of a hateful ideology.
The Radio Satire and Collage Collective, the Department of Corrections.
Hi, this is Scott Gurian, the producer of Peace Watch. If you're enjoying listening to this show, I urge you to take a moment and make a donation to ensure that this program continues. You can make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Or send us a tax-deductible check or money order to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. And note that it's a donation for Peace Watch. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.